For me, my epiphany came about 5 years ago. A friend of mine was a writer for The Economist, and he had done a series of papers on the tremendous budgetary issues that California was having. A lot of it was based off of their prison system. They were just simply locking everybody up. And the thing that really galvanized me to know that this is an issue that has to change and we have to get people to fix it was he showed me one graph. And if you can picture it in your head on the radio or otherwise, it's 1960 and you had higher education at the very top. And way at the bottom, you had spending on prison reform. The graph turns into an exact X. All of the money went to prisons. None of it went to higher education. You saw a California higher education system, which was the envy of the world, perhaps of the history of the world, to one which needs some work. And that made me think, our priorities are really messed up here. So I am grateful. We seem to be hitting a tipping point in conservative, moderate, and liberal states across the country. We are starting to change. We are finally starting to see a little bit of a change nationally, but we have a long way to go, and these are for the people who are doing it for us. With that, let me turn first to Mark Levin to give us the national landscape around corrections and sentencing reform and some of the successes across the states thus far. Mark?
Great. Well, thanks so much, and thank y'all for having me. And it's great to be with two of the best legislators here in Utah. I think this is just such an exciting time to be working on this issue, and we're thrilled that this commission that the governor created in Utah, that these legislative leaders are helping push forward, has come out with some terrific recommendations that will really parallel what's been effective in other states like Texas, North Carolina, Georgia over the last several years. And I think, you know, when you really look at it, this issue is not just about saving money, and I would argue that's not the most important thing. Of course, the most important thing is public safety, making sure victims get restitution, keeping families together, redeeming lives, transforming lives of those many, particularly nonviolent offenders who can be rehabilitated, who can be productive members of our society, can hold a job, take care of their family, and so forth. So, and here in Utah, obviously, if you look at it, 62% of those going into the state prisons are nonviolent offenders. So there is a tremendous opportunity for many of those individuals who are, you know, willing to change to do things, whether it's a drug court or other interventions that will put them on the right track. So it's really a pleasure to talk about what's been going on across the country. Just a couple nights ago, Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey took a lot of time in his State of the State speech to highlight this issue. We've seen many other governors, Governor Nathan Deal in Georgia, Governor Kasich in Ohio, Governor Perry in Texas, Governor Dugard up in South Dakota, really spearheading tremendous reforms, particularly the concept of justice reinvestment. That is, that if we take some of the money that we would otherwise spend locking more and more people up and put that in things like probation and drug courts that hold offenders accountable in the community, that these nonviolent offenders, whether they have a drug problem or whether they stole from someone and need to make restitution, that we can actually put many of them who are willing to change on the right track. And so I think that it's a tremendous opportunity here in Utah. And just to give you a little background about, you know, what Utah is dealing with, currently corrections in Utah prison system costs about $270 million. And since 2004, Utah spending on prisons has gone up 18%, which is six times more than the national average of increase. So you can see that there is a issue in Utah, even though obviously it's a smaller prison system than we have in Texas. In Texas, we have 108 prisons, but just a couple years ago, we had 111. And thanks to Jerry, we were able to close three of them. But I think what's really most stunning is to see that we've been able to dramatically reduce crime at the same time reducing the number of people in prison. So when we started this whole effort in Texas, if you look from then until now, we've seen a decline in crime of 22%. At the same time, we have 12% lower incarceration rate. So I think that's really why you're seeing people across the spectrum come to this issue, because we are able to safely supervise more offenders in the community through things like swift and certain sanctions. One of the interesting things is you look across the country, and it's true in Utah, about half the people coming into prison have failed probation or parole. And about half of those are technical violations, people who missed meetings and things. And we wait oftentimes because we have these huge caseloads on probation until all these violations pile up, and then they go off to prison for 5 or 10 years. Instead, what we can do is put them in jail on the weekend, use electronic monitoring, make sure each time someone misses a meeting or tests positive for drugs, there's a swift and certain consequence. And people will, the data shows, get the message, and many of them comply with probation, do what they're supposed to, and then you don't need to keep using the prison system in that way. Now, it's not just Texas. Other states, like North Carolina, for example, in 2011 adopted a justice reinvestment plan. Since then, they've had a 14% drop in crime. They've had 11% fewer people violating probation. So really, the results speak for themselves. And as you were saying, the consensus across the spectrum, you look at a place like Georgia, 3 sessions in a row adopting unanimously significant adult and juvenile justice reforms, and things involving drug courts, expanding those, changing some of the sentencing laws so that we really focus the prison cells we have on violent and dangerous offenders rather than those people who, for example, simply have an addiction. And so ultimately, I think the vast majority of folks would say, let's reserve prisons for those people we're afraid of, not those we're mad at, and recognize the fact that people can actually get worse in prison, particularly when you take a low-risk, nonviolent offender and put them in with much more hardened individuals who've committed violent crimes, who are involved in gangs and things like that. And then these individuals come out, they can't get a job, they can't get a place to live. Those are the obstacles that people coming out of prison face. And again, we believe in personal responsibility. People are going to prison because obviously they've done something wrong, but we've got to make sure we're holding them accountable in a way that's actually good for the rest of us, that when these folks are in our communities, they're going to be less of a risk to offend. They're going to be productive, contributing members, holding jobs, and helping society as a whole. So I think that as we look at it, Utah is on a great trajectory with these recommendations from the commission that have come out that are really based on the data and evidence. Where we've been able to see who's going into the prison system here, what is their recidivism rate, and unfortunately, 46% are coming back to Utah prisons in 3 years, within 3 years. Newt Gingrich, who's one of the signatories to our Right on Crime Statement of Principles, he said if half the bridges in this country collapsed in 3 years, it would be seen as a scandal. And we need to expect better results in the correction system. And through using evidence-based programs, through models like Earn Time, where people can actually earn time, for example, off their probation term, if they're exemplary, if they complete restitution, obtain a degree, hold a job, go through various rehabilitation programs, we can actually incentivize success. Unfortunately, too often the criminal justice system is one that grows when it fails. The higher the failure rate in our prisons, the bigger and more expensive the system becomes. So we want to really turn the tide on that and have a system that rewards results, and I think Utah can do that. So I look forward to the other comments here today and answering any questions.
Thank you very much. I'll turn it to Representative Madden, who will highlight one state success, which was justice reinvestment in Texas, so we can kind of see how one state did it, and we'll go from there.
I thought it was interesting this morning. I read a tweet by Van Jones. And those of you who know Van is, he's a very liberal commentator and very liberal leader in a lot of things. And he said, you know what, I didn't think I'd ever agree with the Koch brothers, but I do. And he put out the tweet that said, I do on the criminal justice reform issues they're doing, because Charles Koch and others did a article a couple of days ago telling them about what we should be doing in criminal justice reform. And in fact, Van Jones had previously said to Newt Gingrich, when they were doing their firing line, that in fact the right was getting this right, correct, where his liberal friends weren't getting it right. Well, where did it start? Where did all this stuff come from? You got the Pew guys that are all here. Let me tell you, when we started in Texas, there were 2 members of the Pew team. 2. That was it. Nationally. In doing all the stuff they had. Council state governments had a couple of people in their justice center that they were doing some things, but then nobody was doing that. In Texas, I got called into the speaker's office. I've been in the legislature 12 years, just about like you had, and the speaker calls me in one day and he says, Jerry, you're going to be chairman of corrections. And what do you do when the speaker does that to you guys? You say, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I really appreciate the opportunity. And under my breath, I'm saying to me, oh my God, what did I do to deserve this? What happened to me? What did I do? What did I make him mad about? But then I asked him the second most important question I've ever asked in my life. Because I asked him, well, Mr. Speaker, what do you want me to do? And he gave me the 8 words that I think changed my life, and I think have changed the direction in criminal justice reform measures in the whole country. And that was, he said, don't build new prisons. They cost too much. Now, is that a conservative message? Sure. Okay. What do you do? How much do prisons cost? Answer, when I ask a question, is normally going to be a lot. Okay? Prisons cost a lot, right? My lady back there is on the ball already. How many prisoners do we have in the United States? A lot. Yeah, a whole lot. Lots and lots. Texas had one of the three biggest systems in the country. You know where the other two big ones are? One of them's called the federal system, and the other one's California. The California opened the door and let some people out, which I'm not sure whether they had the right approach to it or not. That wasn't the Texas approach that we did. Well, what would we do? I mean, here I am. I am not a lawyer. I had never been on a corrections committee. I'd never had a corrections bill in my life in 12 years. And I'm supposed to figure out how not to build new prisons. What's all the projections going to be? What's the projection for Utah right now? Rising criminal justice population, right? It's right. It's correct statement. It is. And it was in Texas. We had a projection that showed we were going to add 17,700 new prisoners from 2007 to 2012. 17,700. How many prisons is that to hold them? Oh, come on.
A lot.
Eight. At least 7 or 8. At least. How much does that cost? The team's warming up out there. Okay, good. All right, so what's going to be all those things? Well, what do you do, and how do you get the job that says, you know, don't build these? Where do I put them? What are your choices? Well, I looked at it in Texas. I felt there really were only two choices that you could do if you're not going to build new prisons. One, you have to open the door and let people leave earlier, quicker. Or two, you have to figure out a way to slow people down coming in, to get fewer people into the system. Guess what Texas picked? We did not pick open the door and let them out. I don't think Utah would do that either. That's not the right answer either. That's not public safety. Opening the door and letting people out who have not changed, who are not different than the day they walked into the prison, is not, first of all, doing your responsibility as your Department of Corrections, and second of all, it's not doing just the job you're supposed to be doing. So we said that's out, so we said, okay, how do we slow them down coming in? Where do the prisoners come from? And don't say a lot, that's not the answer. they actually come from only three places, at least in most systems. They come from direct sentencing, they're sent there by the court or jury. They're sent there because they violate probation. The court or the court has thought earlier that they could keep them in the community and put them on probation, and then they fail. Or third, they've been in prison, they get out, they're put on parole, and they fail parole and they come back. That's the only three places generally you get prisoners from, okay? So where do you break that prison population cycle? Where do you break that chain, all right? So we started looking at probation. First of all, I decided, how many legislators know anything about corrections? The answer is not a lot. Not a lot, okay? It's a few, okay? It's a very few that know anything about it, okay? So I went out looking for, well, who knows anything about it? Well, I found a couple of members on the House side who were not, let's say, on the same side as the Speaker was. Therefore, I probably couldn't use a lot of their ideas. So I walked over to the Senate, and I said, well, who's over here? And all of my Senate friends, conservative, Republican, Senate friends, said, go to Senator John Whitmire. He's a moderate Democrat, and he's the chairman of the Criminal Justice Committee in the Senate. Go sit down and talk with John. And in an hour and a half, John and I had the meeting, and we basically meshed just like a team, became a team. That's where the bipartisanship started in all this. It wasn't, gee, we're going to dream, we're going to make this all bipartisan, we're going to work. It was, John and I agreed. And we walked out of there with an agreement that we're going to try to move this forward so we don't have to build new prisons. How do you do it? Well, a couple things you need. First of all, you need a lot of data. You need a lot of research. You're going to hear terms research-based, data-driven. Okay, that's an engineer taking charge. That's not the lawyer taking charge. That's the engineer looking at engineering numbers, facts and figures. That's where we started to break the chain, was we started to look at facts and figures. And fortunately, Texas had it. Fortunately, Utah's got a few people who are awfully good at getting data for you, awfully good at helping, and that's an important part of what you get. And you also have some pretty good data, I believe, within your own system that you can use. So data was important to us. We started with that. But lo and behold, we sent a bill over on probation that first year, and it was pretty good. It had such things as drug courts, and in reduced terms of probation in it, and it had things that gave probation officers and probation staff more power. and Governor Perry vetoed it. And as I tell everybody, that's the best thing that ever happened to us. Because it then forced us to look at the whole cycle of what you do. You look at it parole, when they leave prison, when they get out. You look at what you do in the prisons, and what happens there. You look at the probation that you put them on, and how do you handle the probation? What do you do there? Do you do smart and intelligent things there? You look at the sentencing things that you do in the courts, and when they're first arrested. You look at juveniles, the juvenile justice. You look into the schools and see what's happening in the school system. And you look at, you know, early childhood. By the way, I will tell you that early childhood is the quickest and best way to catch them. It's cheapest. If you can intervene with a person early, what's the clearest indicator that a child is going to be a prisoner, a baby is going to be a prisoner? There's statistics that show that. Mom or dad is in prison or has been in prison. That's the quickest number that says the kid's going to be there. Break the cycle. Where do you break it? So we started looking at all these ways to break the cycle. And that's what we did. We went into things like drug treatment programs and alcoholic treatment programs and mental health treatment programs and intermediate sanctions and specialty courts that deal with the specialty cases like drug cases or military veterans or all those things. We looked at all of them. All of them. And we put together what amounted to a package, most of which we passed through the appropriations side, some of which we did with individual legislation, that basically said we're going to make those changes. And when we came out with our package, I had put together three groups to work on the stuff. One was a think tank group. That's where Mark came in. He was there in his first session, and just ready to go into a second session of the Texas legislature that he was working on. And he came in there from Texas Public Policy Foundation. We also had a more left-leaning think tank. But I put him in the same room and said, you guys can work out that probation bill so that we pass it next time. Take it out what the governor didn't like about it. Figure out how we did. And that was their job as part of the commission. I put together a group of staffers in the legislature who knew about the programs and asked the question, does this program work or doesn't it? We killed a bunch of programs, several of them, in the Texas legislature. But we put into place the ones that did work because the numbers showed it. And that's where we expanded to. That's how we got to where we're at. That's how when we passed this legislation in 2007, we had that projection that said we're going to have to build 17,700 more prison beds. We've closed three prisons since then. We did the juvenile justice piece at the same time. We've closed 8 juvenile facilities. We only have 6 left in the state. Took a juvenile population from 4,800 down to under 1,200 that we have in the state facilities. Took a prison population that was 157,000, it's down to 150 and dropping. We took parole rates where we were getting 50% failures on paroles, paroling about 22,000 people every year and having 11,000 come back. The point is last year where we had 28,000 paroled and 5,900 came back. Cut the revocations of parole by almost 40%. Our juvenile arrests are down, and oh, by the way, our crime rate's the lowest it's been since the 1960s in Texas. Our arrest rates are lower than they've ever been. Our juvenile arrest rates are lower than they've been since the 60s anyway. Long time keeping figures. All of those work. Now, we did it state specific. We then expanded out because everybody wanted to hear how in the world did you do this stuff. Okay, so we then expanded out, and that's how Right on Crime basically got going, was basically people wanted to hear what Texas did and how we did it and what can they do in their states. That's where North Carolina came on and Georgia came on and Kentucky came on and Ohio came on and South Dakota. All the states that Mark mentioned all came out from what we'd originally done. Pew staff has gone from those 2 to 2,000. I don't know how many. Maybe a little high. But a whole lot of people working for Pew that are doing this nationally. A lot of other organizations that are now doing it. It's out there. And it's become the mantra of all of these states that are now looking for it. It opens the opportunity. And what we say to Utah is real simple. It's you don't have to reinvent the wheel when you're doing this stuff. There have been states that have done some very creative and unique things that you can use as examples of what you're doing in your legislative package. So that's the message from Texas. That's the message that we've been spreading, and I did it a little longer than 10 minutes. my team, but Texas' story is the whole basis of where all of this has been coming from over the last 10 years.
Thank you very much. We're now honored to have Representative Brad Wilson, Representative Eric Hutchings. I'll kind of let you two go at it. You've both taken prominent roles on different aspects of this. It looks like we'll start with Representative Hutchings.
That'd be great. Thanks. Thrilled to be here. Nice to see some familiar faces in the crowd, and echo what both Jerry and Mark have said. And in fact, it's very interesting. I think one of the unique things about this whole process is that when we first started it, we thought we were really clever and really unique and onto something truly original.
Yeah.
Until we found out people were doing it all over the place. And I think when you talk politics, I think that's a tremendous message to take out of this, is that there are resources in lots of places you don't normally expect. Just like you were saying, there's allies and help in places you wouldn't expect. In fact, having served on this committee, and it, kind of a similar thing, I just got assigned my very first day and have never been able to get off of it. And so I have become a corrections expert by default, almost. But it was really interesting that as we begin working on this stuff, I've run some bills to get started on this, dealing with expungements. Mm-hmm. Helping people get back on track and get their lives back in gear. And, you know, people that have really earned it to figure out how to, you know, get back to where they need to be. And we had a rally, and I was introduced as Democratic Representative Eric Hutchings because how in the world could a Republican do something like this, right? Those cold-hearted, just uncaring. So the reason that I bring that up is you never have any idea where your allies are going to come from. Focus on the issue. Focus on the data. And that's one of the big things that we've discovered, and one of the beautiful things that Pew has done for us. And you guys seriously have been brilliant. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but we almost named one of our new buildings on the Capitol complex the Pew Building. So we may want to rethink that, run a resolution or something. But data is bipartisan, nonpartisan. Science is nonpartisan when used correctly, and it can bring tremendous allies into the same room. And it can be an absolutely wonderful political tool because it's not agenda-driven necessarily. It's not. It's just where do we want to go and how is the best way to get there. And the really unique thing that we're entering into and that you guys are going to enjoy is an era of data. I mean, for a long time, not only was everything siloed, but each county did their own thing, each prison kind of did their own thing, each state did their own thing. Nobody really had any idea what anybody else was doing. Best practices were hard to find, and people did a lot of experimenting, and it was just kind of the flavor of the day. And a tremendous amount of what we're doing is absolutely credited back to the work that was done in Texas and is being done in other states now and has accelerated, I believe, our ability to do this. But Representative Wilson actually kind of takes the brunt of it because I've been working on the reforms portion of it. He's been working on the prison relocation portion of it. So I get to stand in the back as he takes all the arrows. It's kind of nice. Target-wise, I'd be a much easier one, and so I appreciate that it's worked out that way. But the reason I bring that up is it's unique sometimes, and one of the things that I would encourage you guys, if you're interested in politics, one of the things you have to understand is that things come in cycles. There are opportunities, there are waves, there's momentum. And when momentum shows up, you got to ride it. And you got to ride it fast, and you got to ride it as far as you can. And because of the discussion that has started because of the prison relocation move, we have had an opportunity to have really meaningful discussions about the entire process. Because normally getting funding for corrections is a very, very difficult thing to do. While it grows and it's somewhat mandated, and you can scare people by saying, if you don't give me money, we'll let bad guys back into your neighborhood, it's not popular, it's not something people want to talk about, and it's almost never a priority in funding discussions. But when you have a massive ticket item, like hundreds of millions of dollars going into a prison move, suddenly a conversation about $20 million or whatever to do a massive reform package doesn't seem that impalpable. And so it really, is that a real word? You'll have to spell check that for me. But, anyway, but it has given us an opportunity over the last couple of years to have a discussion that we couldn't get people to pay attention to. And thanks to the work that Brad's done to move that forward has allowed us to be able to get the attention and the focus and the resources to do something that we think is going to be really special.
And thank you. Representative Wilson, what about this prison relocation and everything else?
thank you for the invitation to come today. I'll just make a couple of quick comments. And it's great to be here. I've actually never spoken to the Hinckley Institute before, and you invited me, but I've never been able to come. We actually have a few of our finest corrections officers. Was that me? We have a few officers in the back. They probably don't want me to tell you that they're here from the state prison.
A couple probation officers probably looking for some faces. Maybe.
Yeah. But there's some very good people that work out there and do heavy lifting for the state. And one of the things that strikes me, let me just give you a little context for who I am. I am the son of a prosecutor. So my dad spent his entire career sending people to the state prison. And the first time I went down there, and I've been in as a visitor a lot of prisons since I got this assignment, and it's pretty remarkable. If you ever have an opportunity to do that, I'd encourage you to, because you go into these facilities and you see people that look like all of you, and something has happened in their life where they find themselves locked up behind bars, and you have this kind of overwhelming sense of kind of tragedy and this wasted human potential in these facilities. At least that's how I feel when I go into the prisons. And when we talk about the opportunity that's been presented to us, what we really are talking about is how do we help these people who've made bad decisions take personal responsibility and get back on their feet? Because 95% or more of the people that we send to our Draper prison come out. And they shop with you at the grocery store you shop at. Their kids are going to go to school with your kids. And so we have this reality that they go in and they come out. What we need to do is stop having 46% of them go back in. And so that's why this conversation has been so important. The move of the prison has been controversial, rightfully so. It's a big decision that we're making, but it's a very compelling opportunity for the state, and I can speak to that if you want to. This is really more of a discussion around reforming of the system, but these two things came together, and the state will be in a much better place. And the part about this that's been a surprise for me, Kurt, has been when we started down this journey, we were really just looking at the economics of moving the prison, and the economics of moving the prison are very compelling. They make tremendous sense for every taxpayer in the state. The part that surprised me was this window of opportunity that we have to also kind of push the reset button on our correction system. And so that's been the fun part for me and really the big aha.
Thank you. I have about 100 questions, but we have a packed house of students, community, and media. So I'll only ask one, and then I'll turn it over to Lindsay, who will take your questions. And I want to ask Representative Hutchings, this Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, the CCJJ report, is really incredible. For those of you who really want to get into it and truly understand, it's great. We've provided a two-page summary as well as some other things that might be of interest or use to you. But Representative Wilson talked about the economics of it, and right up at the top it says the cost of doing nothing is $542 million. Can you just kind of explain that for everyone who hasn't read the report, and then we'll go to the audience questions?
We have, it's a great point, and Jerry mentioned a little bit earlier that, and even Mark said, and we're following exactly the same thing, you have to begin to look at inmates in a little bit different way. People that have gotten into the justice process, are they really a threat, or are we just mad at them? And we have to manage that very differently. And so part of that growth that you're looking at, that increase, if we don't do anything, and so there's a lot of discussion about the prison, do we move it, do we not move it, do we do reforms and all that kind of stuff. If we stay on the current track that we're currently on, over the course of the next 20 years, it will cost us a little better than $500 million in additional funding, which for the state of Utah is a big deal. For Texas and California, is not percentage-wise, isn't quite as big, but for Utah, that's huge. For a $13 billion state budget, the idea of $500 million additional funding, not going to scholarships and higher ed support and stuff like that, but going to prisons instead. And it's primarily based on the idea that if we keep on the current track, which does nothing to help We have two primary areas where we're focused, where we believe we can make a change. We're breaking it down into three: mental health, substance abuse disorders, and criminogenic. So basically the idea that we need prisons for people that really are bad people, and there really are some bad people out there. And as Brad mentioned, you kind of go into these facilities and there's a bit of a separation depending on which wing you're in. And when you enter the wings where they're really, it's creepy. Don't go to the haunted houses. Just get a tour of the prison with us, and it'll creep you out for a long time. But those other ones, though, that haven't hurt anybody, they're not violent, they just need to get on track, we have a tremendous potential. And so there's a lot of focus going into those two areas, mental health and substance abuse, both within the facilities and then also in the community, and a tremendous amount. Matter of fact, I literally just came from a conversation of all the mental health organizations around the state are meeting here in Salt Lake today to discuss how they might partner on that. And it's a huge, huge effort.
You have a great point on the mental health stuff, because that's one of the Texas's greatest recidivism rate is for people who get out of our prisons with a mental health problem, that don't show up for their first mental health exam back in the community. That's the highest percentage of recidivism we have. It's mental health related. Those people who are mental health type prisoners are going to be the ones coming back if you haven't dealt with them in the proper manner.
And a lot of substance abuse, by the way, is mental health driven.
Mm-hmm. It's
people that are self-medicating in a lot of ways, either from depression or a trauma or what have you. In fact, you mentioned juveniles, and we've taken on the adult group. Our next effort, literally beginning this month, is the juveniles. And we will spend this next year going through a very similar process with the juvenile population, because the data very much proves out that if you help people when they're young, and the interesting thing is that a lot of people that get into the system are there because when you really dig into it, they've had some sort of very traumatic experience in their life. And if you don't deal with the trauma, they go goofy on you, and that's when they start getting themselves into trouble with drugs and violence.
Going back to their families and stuff, but many of the times that's where they've had their traumatic experience too.
Well, and as a mental health issue, I know you said we have a probation officer here. One of the things that's been really effective in Texas is these specialized caseloads for probationers and parolees who have serious mental health problems. So you have a lower caseload for that probation officer, and you have a probation officer who's had special training on mental health issues and who has the bandwidth with that lower caseload to follow up and make sure they're taking their medication, they're going to their counseling appointments, and you get far lower recidivism with that type of, and it costs a few dollars more per day than regular probation, but a fraction of having them go back to prison, not to mention the harm that could come to, you know, if they steal from someone or heaven forbid, hurt someone. So,
thank you. With that, if you have a question, please raise your hand. And when Lindsay gives you the microphone, just please state your name and a concise question so we can get to as many people as possible.
Thank you for having things you had to say. My name is Ben Aldana, and I have a question for Representatives Meepa. I also have a question for Mr. Levin. Question I have for each of our representatives. I read the report of the commission. And it seems implicit in the report that there is a problem with county jails and how the prison sends inmates to county jails, and they're not quite receiving the services that are required, because that seems to be something the commission wants addressed. And I'm kind of wondering, why not just eliminate practice altogether? Mr. Madden talked about the in Texas, there's 108 prisons. Utah has two facilities. Why don't we build a few? Instead of having a 500-acre parcel of land required to build this massive facility, why don't we build a few smaller facilities, maybe more bed space, so that we can keep the inmates from going to the county jails? That way they can get the services they need. They can, you know, there can be more rehabilitation happening in the prison that wouldn't otherwise happen in the county jails. My question for Mr. Levin is regarding federal prisons. I've read a lot of your stuff, and I've kind of just a question about halfway houses. The way the federal halfway houses work, all the ones that I know of are privatized. The one here in the state of Utah, the one in Utah, is a co-ed facility. So men and women both live in the same facility who have just been released after long periods of incarceration. One can imagine all the problems that happen having that situation. I personally have seen it destroy many lives. And I'm just kind of curious about how you think would be the best way to address that. Because I've made efforts to talk to my representatives here in Congress, Mr. Chaffetz and Mr. Lee, about the issue. And their staff have kind of said, thank you very much. Nothing is going to happen because an election's coming up. And I don't know what to do.
The question, please. We need the last.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Do you want to take the first one? Go ahead. I'll add in if you need me to.
So the first question about county jails, just a little context for everyone if you don't understand. About a quarter, is that right? About a quarter of our inmates in the state of Utah are in county jails across the state. And it's done for a number of reasons, cost, proximity to the communities that they're from, different issues like that. And the question basically is, there is some information in the report that is accurate that some of those county facilities don't have the same services and programming that our state prison in Draper has. And because of the lack of programming that some of these county jails have, we are in a situation where some of these inmates, when they're released, don't have the same opportunities while they're in prison and the same tools to succeed when they come out. So that's something that we're looking at. I think just the economic reality of that probably will not allow us to completely eliminate county jail contracting, but probably the solution is to improve the programming and other issues that need to be dealt with in those county jails. So that's the Reader's Digest version of a very big discussion.
Yep,
so.
And just simply to add to that on the county part of it, again, going back to evidence-based practices, and that's where the big change is going to come because programming on one side and programming on another could be very different. But what we have also found is that when people need to reintegrate back into the community is the most critical time. And it's hard to do that when you have one big facility with one front door and they're all going back into the same community. We believe it's much more effective to be able to keep people. And in fact, our hope is that we can partner with and avoid having to build prisons by being able to use more effectively the ability to keep people in their communities close to their support structures and then do some creative things with probation and our adult probation and parole with swift and certain was the term that you used and used the jails very effectively in that method also.
Yes, well, and you know, this may already be being done to some degree, but, you know, the assessment, these risk and needs assessments are really excellent. They're these actuarial instruments. And if you've got somebody in a rural county jail who's got severe mental health issues or other very specialized treatment needs, that person probably is better off in the state. And perhaps there's kind of a trade there because we can use that jail bed on the weekend for that swift and certain instead of revoking some other person on probation. So, you know, obviously from an efficiency standpoint, you're not going to be able to replicate mental health. You may not even have a psychiatrist in some counties who's available. So, you know, doing the assessment can help kind of sort people to the best place. But I think on the latter question, the halfway houses, there was in Pennsylvania, they ran into a lot of issues with the halfway houses there. And one of the things they did was kind of implement some really strong performance measures as to recidivism and results and quality measures as to these facilities, and those that don't make the cut, you know, those contracts are terminated. So I think it needs to be, when we're dealing any type of government contracting, not just the lowest bidder, but making sure we're having outcome-oriented performance measures that we're getting results. Now, you know, another option, of course, is something along the lines of housing vouchers. But one of the things we've seen is a lot of landlords won't rent to someone with a criminal record. And in Texas, we actually have legislation being filed this session, which will say landlords can't be sued if they simply because they rent to someone who's an ex-offender. We actually passed the bill in the 2013 session in Texas that said employers can't be sued simply for hiring an ex-offender, for giving someone a second chance. So, you know, that's another way to try to skin that cat. But, you know, there are people ultimately who come out of our prison systems who there's no family member to take them and they have no money. And so in Texas, we had to expand the halfway houses so that because once you're approved for parole, you still have to have a valid home plan in order to be released. We're not going to release people just to sleep under a bridge. So it's a very challenging area, and it's a good question.
Couple of things. Yeah. First of all, I'm going to tell the truth about Texas. We pulled all of our county prisons back to the state, put them in state facilities. Of course, we had 111, so it wasn't a location problem. They were going to be...
But they had like two in every county, didn't they? Yeah.
Right.
No, we had 254 counties. We did not have one in every county. We're close. Yeah. Now we have eight or nine of them down in Huntsville, different ones around, but now we fall back. Because the exact things that they talked about here was programmatic, and we wanted to make sure they got the programs that we were putting in there, and because the county jails generally didn't provide those kinds of things. Yeah, the only other choice you really had was to contract with them on a halfway house at the federal level. I will say that Representative Chaffetz has actually been working on legislation dealing with criminal justice issues, and is actually one of the major sponsors of pieces going forward right now in the Congress that will do some things. And I will certainly continue discussions with him on federal halfway houses and their utilization, because one of the things we found is that some of the concept might be great, and the implementation may be terrible. You got to overcome that. What we wanted in our prisons, we always said, was we wanted good prisons. We didn't care whether they were private or public or what they were doing. We wanted good ones. You want good halfway houses. You want ones that are doing the kinds of jobs they're supposed to be and have the right kind of situation for the people that are coming back into them. It's one of those things that oversight has to be done. That's the problem with the Department of Justice in manning those houses. So one of the things that they can, and I think should do, is make sure that there's an evaluation of all the programs that are there within DOJ. DOJ's problem right now is their prison population is going so high, it's eating up a huge part of their budget.
Next question.
Corey Boren. Can you explain and conceptualize Utah's current probation system and how that differs from the Swift and Certain probation system, and how the Swift and Certain incentivizes people to properly reintegrate into society?
Thank you.
You want that, or you want me to take that?
I don't want that.
So our current system, we've spent a lot of time over the last couple of years talking to drug court judges, adult probation and parole agents, things like that. And you constantly hear one term that keeps being thrown out there, and that is, we need alternatives to incarceration. And I've been a little frustrated by that, because there hasn't really been a good definition beyond that. And so when you ask them, well, that's great, I'm going to run a bill that says alternatives to incarceration, and we're going to have eight of them. And I don't know what they are, where they are, or how they're going to function. But the thing we're headed towards is exactly what's been talked about, and that is specialization of adult probation and parole. What happens now, and again, I'm not an absolute expert on this, but I have a decent understanding, so there may be some in the room that can clarify to a deeper degree, but it's caseload, and it's almost kind of on just a rotating next person on the list, and who's got how many, and you've got 120, and you've got 125, so we stick the next guy with 120. We have two problems. One, our early risk and needs assessment, and this is classic. I enjoy sometimes how government works. We evaluate what kind of a risk you have and what needs you have about 120 days after we incarcerate you. Which is great, right? So after we sentence you, we put you away, then we go and ask, so what kind of treatment is going to help you? You've already been sentenced, you've already been incarcerated, and then we come back and it's pointless, it's stupid, it's useless. So we're trying to move that whole process to the front, so that when somebody comes in, again, and mental health, substance abuse, a lot of those types of things, we can clearly identify, this is why these problems have been occurring. Like the guy that we have down in Gunnison that honestly thinks he's a pterodactyl. Matter of fact, jumped off of his bunk the other day, broke his arm, eats with his hands behind his back. It takes a different kind of a skill set to work with folks like that, and to just put them out randomly among agents. And so we didn't have, and we're implementing this year, a matrix that allows for things like time earned and stuff like that. And so behavior matters. The reason why you're there matters. The expertise of the individual you're going to be dealing with matters. All of those are happening this year. In fact, I'm the chief sponsor of the legislation that will actually implement several of those. A lot of those can just be done within corrections and within adult probation and parole, but any statutory changes that would mandate that. It's been very vanilla, and because of evidence-based practices and the data that's driving it, radical changes.
Yeah,
and it's becoming very specialized, where before it's just been very generalized.
Yeah, there, you can do some places where you have, you know, just a few people on the caseload, and another person can actually handle 125, 130, depending on what their risk analysis. The Representative Fletcher talked about the risk analysis, and one of the things that they should do more of is risk analysis throughout the system. I mean, there are people who are advocating risk analysis before somebody's sentenced, giving the effect to the judge early in their case. It may be something you want to do even earlier to know whether you got a high risk of violent offenders or somebody who's a high risk of taking drugs. I mean, there's a difference, a big difference. There's differences in risk assessments that you should be doing. I mean, the highest risk assessment, the highest rating of risk assessment always goes to who? Goes to the drug users. They're the highest risk of reoffending. They're addicts. Okay? The lowest risk is to high-level offenders. The murderers get very low risk. Some of them are low risk all the way through. But you knowing the risk of violent offenses is what we really concentrate on, because what you want to do is you want to keep the public safe. That's what it's all about. So the risk analysis should be done. We do them, you know, early in the process. You should. When they're getting incarcerated, the people in the prison system ought to know what they got and who they got. And you ought to do it when they're getting near the end of their prison system, so you can go back and tell your people that they're coming back into the community, what's their risk now? Because they may have changed. Hopefully they have. If you've got a good Department of Corrections, their risks are a lot lower than they were, right? If you do it right. So that's one of the things you want to know.
Our next question.
You mentioned that moving the prisons would be economically advantageous, and I don't know very much about it, but it seems like it would cost a lot to make that move. So, what are the, how does that work? Why is it?
Yeah. I'll walk through the numbers as quick as I can, and we'll see if they make some sense to you. So we have a prison right now. It's got about 4,000 beds in it, and it's falling apart. So we're going to spend over the next decade or so $250 million replacing the same number of beds we have in Draper, if we don't move it. In addition to that, once you figure in that $250 million, if we were to relocate the prison and you move the prison outside of Draper, you probably sell the ground for $100 to $150 million. So you're at about $400 million of costs that other dollars that you've got to use, basically, whether you put the prison in Draper or not. Building a new prison is probably a $500, maybe $525 million expense. Just the construction alone of the new prison will generate about $60 million in taxes. And by redeveloping that 700 acres we have in Draper, you'll generate about $2 billion a year in economic activity and about $100 million a year in taxes. So within about 18 months of relocating the prison, assuming you fully have developed that ground in Draper, the taxpayers are already ahead, just from a dollar standpoint. So 30,000 jobs is what we estimate will be on that 700 acres in Draper by the time that ground is redeveloped. And there are very few things that we do as a legislature that you just know are going to have a huge impact on the economic success and vitality of the state, but this is one of those things. There's not very many times we vote on something and we know we're going to have the opportunity to create 30,000 jobs and $100 million a year in tax revenue for the state, but this is one of those really unique opportunities. You'd be hard-pressed. There probably isn't a metropolitan land holding in the country right now of 700 acres located between two major universities, between two high-tech hubs, that you could turn into a business park very much like the research park up here and create a lot of jobs. So that's a very, very quick summary of just the economic side. Then you factor in on top of that the opportunity that the Department of Corrections has to have a state-of-the-art facility that's safer for their employees and that has the programming opportunities to help reduce recidivism. It's absolutely a no-brainer to make this move and build a new facility.
Well, we're definitely not experts in relocations. We're experts in corrections. But I will say I drove up to Provo for some meetings yesterday, and it was kind of amazing to see this prison amidst, you know, all of these office buildings, condos overlooking the correctional facility. So we did – one of the prisons we closed in Texas was in Sugar Land, was built around 1900. And subsequently, of course, at that point it was all, you know, grassland. But now it's one of the most prosperous suburbs or exurbs of Houston, right next to the General Aviation Airport. So basically it was a similar situation, not on your scale, but that prison was falling apart and the land was worth $30 to $50 million, and so that was one of the reasons it was closed.
And the local community wanted it very badly.
That's true, wanted it closed.
Our next question.
My question is for the representative of Utah, Mr. Levin, as well. You guys have talked a lot about the costs of lowering the rate of recidivism and the cost of programs preventing people from entering prisons, and what techniques, what alternative financing techniques has the government looked into for lowering these rates, such as social impact bonds?
What? Go ahead. Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, that, I can tell you for Utah, and then I'd love for you to pitch in on top of that. I'm taking a mental note about being able to Google social impact bonds as soon as I walk out of the room. Our funding streams to this point are just basic governmental funding sources. Brad mentioned very nicely the what we hope will be some help in being able to cover the costs of what we're doing to deal with the prison and using that as a springboard to try and work all these other reforms. But what we're hoping to make the argument for, and we believe that the data backs it up very, very nicely, is that it's not just, and one of the things that we've had to redefine is that the cost of being incarcerated is not just the cost of being incarcerated. You have a mom who's a meth addict, right? Single mom, two little kids. You incarcerate mom, what happens? Well, you got to take care of the kids, right? So now you got DCFS involved, you've got foster care, you got and not only that, once they get out, well, now what? Where do I live? I can't find a place to live because we got good landlord laws everywhere, and so now you have this real struggle. They can't get a decent job. And so from the state side of it, there are tremendous costs that we are beginning to very aggressively promote that incarceration is not just the daily rate of keeping somebody behind bars and giving them food, that it has a very broad impact that lasts an awfully long time. And so how we do this specific funding, I'm very interested in any ideas that come up with that, but what I can say is that because of the research that has been done, we're very confident that we can make a great argument that reforms over time will save the state of Utah huge amounts of money, and not just in the little silo of corrections and adult probation and parole.
I would just add, so we have not specifically looked at social impact bonds for any part of this public policy debate yet, but this is one of those parts of the discussions that we have that cuts across party lines. You see Democrats and Republicans down at the Capitol who all kind of line up in similar ways around all this reform and even, quite frankly, the prison move. And one of the things that you're also seeing is we did step into social impact bonds as a state this last session. It was not around corrections, it was around education. But there is a movement. In fact, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams, who's someone that we work terrifically well with and has helped with the prison effort, is doing some work around social impact bonds, and I would imagine that they'll be part of the discussion. And Ben has been great to work with on all these issues. So
in one of the aspects of the recommendations is incentive funding, which is something that Texas has adopted in the juvenile system, and Ohio in their juvenile system, Illinois. But basically the idea being that when a county reduces the number of nonviolent offenders they're sending to state prisons and also achieves certain benchmarks in terms of reducing recidivism, increasing the percentage of probationers that are current on restitution and so forth, they get a share of the savings to the state. So it's kind of a way to have a cost sharing between the local and state governments. I think that certainly as you look towards approaches, whether it's using county jails for a weekend in jail as a swift and certain sanction, or you look at maybe some things that should be misdemeanors that are now felonies. A number of jurisdictions have reduced low-level marijuana to misdemeanor over a number of years. And so there may be situations where counties are handling cases that would have previously been felonies at the state level. And in Texas, I'll tell you, we made sure there were no unfunded mandates when we in the juvenile system said we're not taking misdemeanors, kids who did graffiti or marijuana, into our state youth lockups anymore. This was in 2007. We said we're going to take half of what we were spending on incarcerating those misdemeanor children at the state level and give those back to counties. And it's worked out very well in terms of both lower recidivism and, of course, taxpayers saving the other half of what we had been spending. So there are very innovative ways to do the funding models. Obviously, New York and Massachusetts are some of the states pursuing the – we actually don't call it the social impact bonds, because sometimes policymakers get a little scared, I think understandably so as a conservative, when you talk about bonds and going into debt. But it really is the private sector. We call it success-oriented funding. But the private sector is taking the risk. And basically, they put up the initial, the seed money, and they only get paid back to the extent recidivism is reduced, and therefore fewer people coming to prison and the state saving money. So it's a way of shifting the risk from the taxpayers to the private sector.
Mark hit on an important point, too, for everybody here. Labeling is extremely important. How you say stuff, how you say it so that it has a different sets of meaning for the different people that are out there, and say it in such a way that it's broad and it's acceptable to as many people as you can have it said. And that's what happens, obviously, with our utilization of funding and alternative methods of funding.
And one other thing, you know, people on probation, at least in Texas, they pay $50 or $60 a month, not to mention $50 or $60 million a year aggregate in restitution, another $60 million in community service hours if they were being paid at minimum wage, which is like cleaning up trash on the side of the road. And I think they do that in Utah, too, plus paying a lot of child support, none of which people in prison do. So those are major factors when you think about this, too.
I had lots of cases of mothers coming in and wanting funding, or wanting people to, their deadbeat dads, to pay the money for their kids. And where was the dad at? Oh, he's locked in prison. And I'd have to look at him and say, well, how much does he earn when he's there? And the answer is not a lot. Okay? In fact, it's probably nothing or very close to it. Okay? So there's very little money that deadbeat dad has. We have that kind of thing. The great things that these guys have talked about, if you look at all the problems that are out there that we have, unwed mothers that are there, and school dropouts that are there, and drug utilization and violence in the community, and where do all their prisoners go back to? And if you map that in Utah, just like we did in Texas, you'll find that that's a close area. There's areas where there's practically none of any of those, and there's areas where there's whole lots of them. The colors of the map, very dark, whatever it's going to be. But if you start having an impact of putting fathers back in their families, putting mothers back with their children, doing those kinds of things that we do when we're talking about the things now in the criminal justice system and making that difference. It's amazing how, as we said, when we did our Texas thing, we looked at the whole system. We looked at infant programs. We looked at the family nurse-family partnership program. That was a big one for us at that time that provided a nurse, low-income, first-time mothers get a nurse for the first 24 months of their child's life and started at their 26th month of pregnancy. Huge difference that it makes, and very cost effective in doing the kinds of things that it can do. So there's other things out there that can be done. And it's that core that we're attacking, that if we could just have the kind of an impact that says those kids don't get involved in the criminal justice system, they don't get involved in the drugs, and they don't drop out of school, what an impact that would have in two generations if you could do that in both Utah and Texas, and those kinds of things that we're starting.
Well, thank you, and thank you for being here. We owe all four of you a big debt. But for us, especially for you college students, hopefully through their efforts, we as the United States and we as Utah won't be in the neighborhood we are right now. Right now, our prison populations echo more of the North Korea, China, countries like that. We're totally out of whack with the Australias and Canadas and Western European countries that we oftentimes try to compare ourselves with. hopefully through your efforts, we will get back into the neighborhood where we feel more comfortable, where we provide better opportunities for these families and for everyone. We save money. It just seems like a win, no matter what your ideology or party. And so I appreciate your pioneering work here, and appreciate you you sharing your expertise with us today. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for your great questions.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.